and sort of, and then even sit next to her until she would fall asleep. And then what would happen then is that he would then start studying. And not just that, and even if he was up late studying, if one of his kids, for example, his daughter woke up and asked him to draw something for her, he would also do that. Welcome back. This is A to Z and R Being English Radio, and obviously I'm talking about the energy, the concern, the patience that obviously our martyrs have for other people, and obviously the most pure-hearted people have for others, so that they never sort of really express to others quite how tired they are. And obviously the martyr I was referring to, Pervez Khosrow, he, despite working and studying and having young kids, he would still find time, even though he's up late at night studying, to still entertain the kids if they woke up and needed something from him, wanted him to do something for them. And you, this is obviously, this shows so many different things. Obviously his... he is so devoted to his family, to being a good father for the children. And obviously he has the responsibility of being both the provider, being the father, also having responsibilities towards his university, so also having to keep up with his study. And at the root of this is also sort of suppressing any desire, any desires his ego might have had, to just sort of say to him, oh, look, I'm really tired, can't I just go and sleep, rather than you staying up and drawing these pictures for the daughter. So that wasn't there. So how many of us have this calmness, this patience? I'd always say this obviously comes from this level, this piety, and being a really good servant of Allah, being that close to Allah, that everything we do, in a sense, is for Allah and is for others. So it really just is about serving. And as a servant of Allah, of course, we can serve. It's one of the best things is to serve others, serve humanity. Some people do it by serving nature, by protecting nature, protecting the environment, and so on. So inshallah, these are just a few extra points for all of us. And I, inshallah, you tune into another episode of A to Z here on IB English Radio. And farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Interested to know about history, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune in to IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
In the limelight.
The American Brown University could become the fifth university in the country to lose federal funding. All the schools that have their federal funding slashed so far are Ivy League institutions. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, the Trump administration is reportedly targeting a $510 million cut in federal contracts and grants to Brown University for alleged anti-Semitism on campus and reviewing their diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, while it aggressively expands its campaign to hold U.S. universities accountable, according to reports. The Daily Caller was the first to report on the freeze recently, with CNN saying that it also heard the news from a White House official. While university officials said they had not been formally notified, the school was among dozens warned in March that enforcement actions could be coming as the administration seeks to crack down on academic institutions. Rhode Island's Brown University has an endowment that was valued at $7.2 billion last summer. Brown Provost Francis J. Doyle III sent a message to stakeholders across campus recently saying they were aware of troubling rumors emerging about federal funding cuts to research grants. The provost said, according to a statement shared with the Middle East Eye, "We will not repeat these various rumors, including unsubstantiated reports by online outlets, but it is important to share that at this moment, we have no information to substantiate any of these rumors. In your respective roles as chairs and faculty directors, please share this information with your concerned faculty. We are closely monitoring notifications related to grants, but have nothing more we can share as of now." Similar to dozens of other universities, students at the Ivy League school protested against Israel's war on Gaza, setting up an encampment on the grassy quad at the heart of Brown's campus. But unlike at many other universities, Brown administrators chose to negotiate rather than clear the demonstrations forcefully. It has become the fifth known and latest Ivy League university to potentially face a loss of their federal funding. In March this year, Columbia University became the first university to lose some federal funding when the Trump administration slashed $400 million in federal funds. In a press statement at the time, the agencies involved in reviewing the university said the funding cuts were due to the school's continued inaction in the face of persistent harassment of Jewish students. Secretary of Education Linda McMahon said in the press release, "Since October 7, 2023, Jewish students have faced relentless violence, intimidation, and anti-Semitic harassment on their campuses, only to be ignored by those who are supported to protect them." The statement warned that the cancellations represent the first round of action, and additional cancellations are expected to follow. Columbia University currently holds more than $5 billion in federal grant commitments. The amount announced in March is almost eight times more than the amount the Federal Task Force on Anti-Semitism announced it was considering holding earlier. On April 1st, the Trump administration suspended several dozen research grants totaling $210 million to Princeton University as part of an ongoing investigation into anti-Semitism on campus, according to the White House and the Department of Energy. Princeton President Christopher Isgrabber said in a message on April 1st to the university community that the full rationale for this action is not yet clear. Meanwhile, on March 31st, the government told Harvard University it would review nearly $9 billion in multi-year grant commitments to the university as part of an investigation over anti-Semitism. The review will include more than $255.6 million in current contracts and $8.7 billion in grants spread over multiple layers. Harvard University has also been given a set conditions that it must meet, including a mask ban and removal of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs to receive federal money. The review is being conducted by the Department of Education, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the U.S. General Services Administration. McMahon said in a statement that while Harvard has served as a symbol of the American dream of generations, it had failed to protect students from anti-Semitic discrimination and had promoted divisive ideologies over free inquiry. The Trump administration's cancellation of $400 million in federal funding to Columbia University demanded in exchange that Columbia change its disciplinary policies and place its Middle Eastern, African, and South Asian studies programs under administrative control. Columbia University caved to many of the Trump administration's demands, but the exchange resulted in national backlash and the abrupt departure of the university's interim president, Linda Armstrong, last week. The University of Pennsylvania, President Donald Trump's alma mater, was hit with $175 million in cuts over policies allowing some issues to compete in women's sports. In an announcement on March 10th, the Department of Education published a list of 60 universities that are presently under investigation for Title VI violations relating to anti-Semitic harassment and discrimination. Human rights advocates and academic experts have condemned the moves as an assault on freedom of speech and academic freedom.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
As if the relentless bombing and the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza were not enough, the one sanctuary where Palestinians should have felt safe became a death trap. The protection of hospitals during warfare is paramount and must be respected by all sides at all times. These were the words of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, describing the hospitals in Gaza that should be protected under international law. The Geneva Convention states that medical units shall not be the object of attack. They shall be respected and protected at all times and shall not be used for military purposes. The wounded and sick shall be collected and cared for. Since the beginning of Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, which has claimed the lives of over 50,000 Palestinians and wounded 113,000 others, Israel has repeatedly targeted hospitals, committing mass atrocities against those seeking refuge in medical facilities, facilities that are protected under international law. These attacks intensified with the onset of ground operations, almost destroying every major medical center in Gaza, and leading to the killing, persecution, and kidnapping of the people and the medical personnel. A ceasefire agreement was reached on January 19, 2025, with the expectation that humanitarian aid and supplies would flood Gaza, improving the health system and allowing for the urgent evacuation of patients. However, Israel failed to meet its obligation, and by March 1st, declared the complete suspension of humanitarian supplies to Gaza, including fuel to operate remaining hospitals. On March 13th, the 53rd day of the ceasefire, a United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry published a report listing certain Israeli violations against Gaza's medical facilities as genocidal acts. How did Israel respond? On March 18th, Israel resumed its large-scale attacks across Gaza, collapsing the ceasefire and killing over 850 Palestinians. The following Sunday, on March 23rd, at least 15 civil and medical crew members went missing in Rafah following their operations there to rescue the Palestinians who were targeted and trapped by the Israeli occupation forces on the ground. Later that day at 9 p.m., Israeli bombed the male surgical department inside Nasser Medical Complex in central Khan Yunis, killing two Palestinians, including a child, and injuring eight others and rendering the entire department out of service. I'm Ahmed al-Najjar, and today for more on this to discuss the deteriorating health system under Israel's ongoing aggression, I am joined by Dr. Farouz Sidwa, an American trauma and general surgeon based in California and is now volunteering here in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza Strip. Dr. Farouz, thank you so much for joining us, for finding time amid all that you are experiencing these days. Thank you. So, from California to the Gaza Strip, during a very critical and challenging time and reality here in Gaza, if you could share with us your journey, what brings you here to the Gaza Strip? And we understand that you've been here in certain key periods all over the course of this genocide. You've been here last year, and you came back during the ceasefire, and now witnessing the resumption of that genocide. How would you describe the health system situation in Gaza during these three periods?
Yeah, the first time I was here was 1 year ago, March 25th to April 8th, and I was on the eastern side of Khan Yunis at European Hospital, Gaza. And that back then, the hospital basically wasn't functioning. It was because the refugees were inside the hospital, and basically the hospital was a shelter more so than a hospital. We lacked supplies. We lacked almost everything that we needed. But the biggest problem was just there was no way for a hospital to function like this. And the same was happening at Nasser. The same was happening. Literally every hospital was the same way because people had nowhere to go, nowhere that they thought was safe. So now that I'm back, Nasser was raided and put out of service by the Israelis in March of last year. So about a year ago. And in, I think, May, it reopened, maybe. And the administration decided that they won't allow refugees into the hospital again. So this has allowed the hospital to function properly, but that is the only improvement. that I have seen. Otherwise, everything is worse, even before the ceasefire, honestly. Even before the ceasefire was destroyed. When I came back, it was March 6th. It was the first day I worked here. And the first case that I saw was a 24-year-old man, and he was crawling through the ruins of his apartment trying to find the body of his father, who had been killed many months ago. And the building collapsed on him, and it tore his left kidney off of his aorta. So he almost bled to death. It also broke his spine. He may never use one of his legs again. The next case I saw was a young man shot in the left chest in Rafah from the large sniper tower that the Israelis have built there. And he came in, we put a chest tube in him, we operated on him, thankfully he did okay. But all of this just shows you that number one, the violence didn't stop. Even though there weren't major explosions happening in Khan Yunis, the explosions that happened months ago were still killing people. When their houses would collapse on them, when children would fall out of the window or off the third floor because the buildings were not stable. This is a major problem. This was a major problem. And then the shootings from the Israelis didn't stop. It was much less, of course, but it didn't stop. And the fact that the territory, Gaza, still has no normal connection to the outside world, even during the ceasefire, no normal connection to the outside world. I think you mentioned the Israelis never allowed the tents in that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the mobile homes that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the proper number of aid trucks in. They prioritized the wrong type of aid, the wrong types of food, things like snacks instead of things like meat for a population that's been malnourished for a year, and especially milk for children, things like this. And then they didn't allow for the evacuation of of wounded people like they said they would, and they tried to restrict, and in fact did restrict, the entrance of foreign medical personnel like myself, coming from the United States, from Europe, from Australia, Jordan, wherever. So overall, the situation actually just continued to get worse. It's true that from January 19th to March 18th, when there was a bit of a ceasefire, some more food got in, and there was some more water availability, some fuel came in. But on, March 2nd, I think, the Israelis closed the border again. And since then, there has been no way for people to afford protein to eat. They can only afford the bread and rice that they get from the World Central Kitchen, the World Food Program. There has been no resupply of hospitals. The Nasser still has what we need to do life-saving operations to stop people from bleeding to death, but they don't. We don't have the equipment needed to do reconstructive work. So, for example, a lot of people, including children, have had blast injuries to their arms, and they didn't die. So, alhamdulillah, thankfully, great. That's great. But they have nerve injuries, so their hands are clawing. They're not able to use their hand properly. This is going to be a disabling injury forever.
A question. The lack of supplies to Gaza, the lack of all humanitarian supplies for the people here, since the start of that genocide, all the needs of the people have been weaponized against them. After the start of the ceasefire, the flow of aid, the improvement for the life here should have been achieved. Yet somehow it got worse. By March the 2nd, the suspension of all humanitarian supplies to Gaza, food, the cutting of power to one of the last desalination plants here in southern Gaza. And of course, how this affects the medical facilities here with the patients inside them. Now, many of the people here, the injured, the wounded, are fortunate to have such expert medical professionals like yourself. But even with that, the lack of supplies is pretty much challenging. How do you manage these challenges?
Yeah, so it's a few things. Number one, for my own work as a surgeon, we don't have all of the supplies that we would normally have, even in a poor country's hospital. We don't have wound vac supplies anymore. The certain types of sutures are harder to find. Right now, at Nasser, we do have the equipment that we need to do life-saving care, but not reconstructive care, so that people can improve their lives also. At other hospitals in Gaza, and especially in the north, the supplies are gone. There's very little that's available. They're making do with the wrong things, but they have no choice. Anesthetics are gone. Antibiotics are not available. Thankfully, here the situation is better, but it will not last forever because, like you said, the border is closed. So the hospital cannot purchase new material. It can't receive new material. And it's not just humanitarian aid that's not being allowed in. Nothing is being allowed into Gaza, not normal commerce. You can't purchase something and have it shipped here because the Israelis simply won't allow it. It doesn't matter if you paid for it. It doesn't matter if it's donated. It's nothing. And but beyond just the surgical supplies in the hospital, the fact that people don't have clean water means they're coming in sick even before they get injured. The fact that they don't have protein to eat means that their body will not heal properly and they will not fight infections properly, no matter what we do. So, and the fact that they have no homes. I mean, in the background here, you can see every building is seriously damaged. They have no homes, no way of protecting themselves from the weather. So all of this takes a toll on the human body, slowly, slowly, slowly. And all of it is resulting in the health of people being much, much lower than it should be.
And when it comes to this resumption of the large-scale attacks across the Gaza Strip since about March 18th, how do you describe the situation in the hospital, the number of the patients, the wounded received here? How do you keep up with treating such large numbers?
Yeah, so actually the Palestinians have learned to do what we call mass casualty very well, just from a lot of experience, unfortunately. Not just in this war, but in the previous ones as well, during the Great March of Return, all these things. So they have an efficient system in place, but again, without supplies, without the needed number of surgeons, without the needed number of operating rooms, without beds. I mean, this whole ward has been destroyed, and the 26 beds that were here, we can't use anymore, because how can you house someone in this place? So it's making it very challenging to keep up with the injured. Most of them, even though we can fix their surgical problem, they're still very sick and they need an intensive care unit, the ICU. But we don't have the supplies that are needed or the personnel or the infection control measures. All of this is not available. And so many patients that we save in the operating room die in the ICU later, mostly of infections. Simply because we just don't have the supplies, the resources to care for them. We can't test them properly to see what infection they actually have. Here at Nasser Hospital, we don't have a neurosurgeon. The only neurosurgeons are at European hospitals. So if somebody has bleeding in their abdomen, but they also have a bad brain injury, this is the biggest hospital in Gaza right now because Shifa is mostly non-functioning. So in the biggest hospital in any place, you would have a general trauma surgeon and a neurosurgeon. They could work on the patient at the same time. But right now, we have to stop the bleeding in the abdomen, hope that the brain injury doesn't kill them for 2 days, and then we can send them to European hospital for brain surgery. But at that point, they don't even need it anymore. They lived, you know. So these are very, very challenging things. And again, with a population that is so sick to start with, you know, the children have not had clean water for almost 2 years. They've not gone to school for almost 2 years. They haven't eaten normally for almost 2 years. They've been displaced over and over and over again. Their levels of stress are through the roof. So it's a very, very challenging thing to take care of.
So speaking of this ward we are sitting right now, the male surgical department inside the Nasser Medical Complex, a ward filled with wounded people who survived the attacks of the Israelis and finally grateful to receive some sort of treatment that hopefully would help them survive. The Israeli missiles followed them where they are seeking treatment. A man and a boy, how do you respond to this?
Well, they're criminal. And in the case of the attack on this ward, actually, I was almost killed here. The emergency medical teams live on the fourth floor of the hospital, and this is the second floor. And I was coming down to change a patient of mine, his dressings. This is a 16-year-old boy named Ibrahim Barhoum. I was on my way to change his dressings and just 10 minutes before the bombing. And I have to walk past the intensive care unit to come down here. And one of the doctors there said, "Oh, Feroz, can you help us with this other patient because they're bleeding and we don't know what to do?" So I said, "Oh, yeah, sure." So I went in there, assessed that patient. That took about 10 or 15 minutes. And then I said, "Look, we need to take this guy to the operating room So I told the ICU, you tell the operating room so that they can do that, and then I'm going to come change Ibrahim's dressing, and then I'll come back and we'll do the operation. But when I walked out of the ICU, that's when the bomb went off. And I would have, I assume Ibrahim was right here. I would have been standing right here working, just changing his abdomen, talking to his family, because he was going to go home the next day. He was well. So you know, that hit me very personally, obviously. Number one, because my patient was killed. I've never had a patient killed in their hospital bed before. But number two, I've also never been that close to being killed by a military strike. So, but no, it's criminal. It's criminal in two different ways. Number one, hospitals are civilian objects in international law. And medical personnel, meaning me as a doctor or somebody as a nurse, whatever, are also protected people. And it's not just the doctors and nurses, it's actually also the administrators that work in a hospital. Basically, everyone who provides care to the wounded is protected. And that's not just part of the Fourth Geneva Convention from the 1940s, I suppose. It's actually part of the very first Geneva Convention of 1864. So we're talking about, you know, during the time of the American Civil War, things that people said should be illegal in warfare. That's what the U.S. and Israel are doing now. It's really crazy. But number two, so that's one thing. Patients medical personnel in hospitals are protected. But like you mentioned, hospitals are not to be militarized. And the Israelis have been claiming that Ismail Barhum, simply because he is in Hamas, his presence here is militarization of the hospital. They also said he's planning terrorist attacks here, but that's ridiculous. The hospital is a free area. Everybody could walk around and do whatever they wanted. Nobody saw any such thing. I looked at his picture, actually, because I'd never met him. So I looked at his picture online today. I never saw that man doing anything, walking over. They said he had been here for weeks. It's ridiculous. But so the actual facts of the matter are that he was wounded in a bombing on either the 18th or the 19th. And then he came here to seek treatment because he was probably trying to recover without being in public. But then he couldn't, so he came here to seek treatment. Not only are hospitals and medical professionals protected, but wounded combatants, leaving aside that he's not a combatant, he's just a civilian, but wounded combatants are also protected under international law. When a person is wounded in battle, and then they are being cared for by a medical professional, the doctor, but also the patient, are protected. So it's a double crime. It's a crime to attack the hospital at all, but it's also even a crime to kill Ismail Barhum. Because, I understand he's in Hamas, he does the finances or something, but that doesn't mean you can just kill him. And we can see it very easily if we just look at Israel instead. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu had his prostate removed, so it's a surgery, in late December, I think maybe December 27th or something like that. And the next day, I'm sure from his hospital, because he was in the hospital for 4 days, I'm sure from his hospital room, he was running the Israeli war effort. So he militarized a hospital, for sure. Does anyone think that Hamas can go into that hospital and shoot him in the head? No one thinks this. It's crazy. So why is the opposite allowed? Or why is it allowed if the shoe is on the other foot?
Speaking of Benjamin Netanyahu and the militarization of hospitals, I was actually speaking to the director of field hospitals here in Gaza about the targeting of this department. And he said that nothing justifies the targeting of medical facilities. Even if Benjamin Netanyahu himself was being treated inside this hospital, nothing justifies it. Nothing allows anyone to target hospitals.
And just think about it this way. Suppose an Israeli soldier was wounded and a Palestinian brought him here to the hospital and I did surgery on him. Can Hamas bomb this hospital to kill the Israeli soldier in his bed? It's insane. Nobody would accept this.
And the Israelis just keep using this pretext of that hospitals are being used for military purposes by military groups, terrorist groups, and the Gaza Strip. But what is happening is that the Israelis themselves are coming in and turning these hospitals into military barracks. So what kind of paradoxical concept is that?
Well, it's a good question, and this is where you see that some people are considered human beings in the Western media and some people are not. Not just the Western media, the Western culture in general. The Israelis occupied Turkish Friendship Hospital, which is north of here, just outside of the Netzarim corridor. They occupied it, I think, in July and destroyed almost the entire hospital. just bit by bit, not blowing it up, just smashing this, smashing that, breaking this, breaking that. And a lot of them, the soldiers were putting videos online of them doing this. Oh, look, I'm going to smash this ultrasound machine. I'm going to smash this monitor just for fun because they were bored inside the hospital. So they turned it into a military barracks, right? Well, okay, that's militarization of the hospital. They kicked all the patients out, of course, and there was, you know. So that's militarization of the hospital. So if Hamas were to attack Israeli soldiers in that hospital at that time, especially when there's no patients and the hospital isn't functioning, nobody would claim that this is a crime. But now, just a few days ago, maybe on the 17th, I think, maybe on the 22nd, I can't remember exactly, the Israelis went back to Turkish Friendship Hospital, laid out charges, put up a video camera outside the hospital, and just blew it up on camera. How could it possibly be justified? But this is the thing. It just doesn't matter in the Western discourse, in the United States, in Europe. It doesn't really matter. You're not allowed to just say the simple and obvious truth. The Israelis are deliberately destroying a healthcare system with the backing of the United States and Europe. You're not allowed to just say simple things that are obvious to anybody with half a brain can figure it out. Now, you ask a 10-year-old kid to look at the evidence, they'll tell you exactly what's going on. But you're not allowed to say it. And this is what perpetuates the idea. The only way that this can come about is because Palestinians, Arabs in general, but especially Palestinians, are just not seen as human beings.
So coming to my final question, and forgive me for taking it to a personal level. On October the 2nd, 2024, you, among 99 other medical professionals who served here in Gaza during this genocide, wrote a letter to the Biden administration at the time, urging them to stop arming Israel. In it, you stated your testimonies, what you've witnessed as medical professionals, your expertise poured in that letter, and the atrocities you've witnessed. You said in it, and I quote, "I have never seen such injuries on such massive scale. With so few sources, our bombs are cutting down women and children by thousands. Their mutilated bodies are a monument of cruelty." The Biden administration is gone. Trump's administration now is in charge. Trump presented himself as the peacemaker, the anti-war president, and all of a sudden, this changed, and is now basically telling Israel to finish the job. How do you, not only as a medical professional, but as an American citizen, what do you think would convince this administration to stop arm Israel?
I don't know what would convince them, but I am a doctor, so I come to places like Gaza. I've also worked in Ukraine. I've worked in plenty of other places, too. And one of the advantages of coming to a place like this is you see that people are just human beings everywhere. Everyone wants to take care of their family. Everyone wants to have enough food to eat. Everyone wants to enjoy their culture. Nothing unusual. And the same is true here. And when I go back to the United States, I can tell people about the professional work I did, which I do, but I also want people to understand that we are committing crimes in Gaza. People use the word complicit. They say America is complicit in Israel's crimes, but this isn't correct. That implies that Israel is committing the crimes and we're just in the background or something. The U.S. and Israel are committing crimes in Gaza together. It's American airplanes, it's American helicopters, it's American bombs, even the tanks, these vaunted Merkava tanks. They're basically made in the United States. So I don't accept that my government has to be involved in committing crimes against people who have done us no wrong. And so what would convince the Trump administration? I don't know. But I hope something will, and I'll keep trying to find it until I can.
Dr. Farouz Sidwa, thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us and for your efforts and everything you've done here in Gaza. Thank you so much for joining us in this special program. Hope you stay safe, and goodbye for now. Thank you.
باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
فدعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان. ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we are joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam, brother Mahdi, and assalamu alaikum to all of the dear listeners of this program, and thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, this program, Let's Recite the Quran, consists of several Quranic parts. First, we are going to talk about a famous Quran reciter. Then, we are going to listen to a recitation by that reciter. After it, Brother Muhammad will analyze that recitation. So please stay tuned. Today we are going to listen to a recitation by Sheikh Raghib Mustafa Ghalwash. This Egyptian reciter was born in 1938 in a village of the city Tanta in Al-Gharbiya Governorate. When he was a teenager, he memorized the Noble Quran. Then he finished his recitation course under the care of Sheikh Ibrahim Salam. When he was 16, he took part in Quranic gatherings as a reciter. And at the age of 24, he officially joined Egyptian radio and television. You know, he might be the youngest Egyptian radio reciter. For a long time, he followed Sheikh Mustafa Ismail's style of recitation, but after a while, he invented his own new style. He traveled to many countries, including France, US, England, and Canada. And in one of his trips, some Christian audience, having heard his recitation, converted to Islam. In 1990, he traveled to Iran and recited the Quran in the presence of Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and was appreciated by him. This prominent master of Quran recitation passed away in 2016 at the age of 78. May Allah bless him. Now let's listen to the recitation of verses 7 to 9 of Suratul Qasas, recited by Sheikh Raghib Mustafa Ghalwash, preceded by its English translation. Let's enjoy it.
In the name of Allah, the absolutely merciful, the especially merciful. And we inspired the mother of Moses, saying, "Suckle him, but when you fear for him, then cast him into the river, and fear not, nor grieve. Verily, we shall bring him back to you, and shall make him one of the messengers." Then the household of Pharaoh picked him up, that he might become for them an enemy and a cause of grief. Verily, Pharaoh, Haman, and their hosts were sinners. And the wife of Pharaoh said, "A comfort of the eye for me and for you. Do not kill him. Perhaps he may be of benefit to us, or we may adopt him as a son." And they did not perceive.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وأوحينا إلى أم موسى
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, you're still listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran, and what you just listened to was recitation of Suratul Qasas, verses 9 to 11, recited by Sheikh Raghib Mustafa Ghalwash. Now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Raghib Mustafa Ghalwash is reciting in the style of Sheikh Mustafa Ismail, almost. It's very similar to the way Sheikh Mustafa Ismail recites. We've said this before many times, that once Sheikh Mustafa Ismail was listening to the radio, and apparently he thought that he is reciting the Quran. but he was like, I don't remember where and when I recited and actually performed this recitation. And he was like, and then he found out that this was actually Raghib Mustafa Ghalwash who was reciting the Quran. That's how exact Sheikh Raghib Mustafa Ghalwash would
imitate
it and follow the style of Sheikh Mustafa Ismail. Later on, of course, he developed his own style of recitation. And Sheikh, let's go and talk about the tajweed now.
Good idea.
Sheikh Raghib Mustafa Ghalwash is doing Fawq Tawassut of Maddul Munfasil. He's reading the Maddul Munfasil with Fawq Tawassut.
With five vowel counts.
Right. And he says, وَأَوْحَيْنَا إِلَىٰ أُمِّ مُوسَىٰ. And see, these are all Maddul Munfasils.
Disjunct, man.
Disjunct, where the long vowel and the kaz, which is the hamza, they're in two different words. أَوْحَيْنَا إِلَىٰ. إِلَىٰ أُمِّ. See, these are two words.
Yeah.
مُوسَىٰ. Again, two different words. So how many mads do we have just in this phrase?
Three. Three Maddul Munfasil.
We have three Maddul Munfasils. Al-Ru'ih. The Lod has to be pronounced with the lowest level of tafkhim, because Lod here has a kasra.
The fifth level.
And Al-Ru'ih. Fa'idha khifti. Again, the khwa should be pronounced with the lowest level of tafkhim. Khifti. We shouldn't say khifti. Khifti is incorrect, because the point is with tafkhim, whenever the letter of isti'la has a kasra or ya'ul mad, is that you have to preserve the sound of the kasra or ya'ul mad. Arudri. Khifti. If you say khifti, you're changing the way that the kasra is pronounced.
And the way to apply it is actually the way lips are dropped.
Yes, that's right. The way that you would pronounce a kasra. Mm-hmm. How would the shape of the lips be when you pronounce kasra? It should be the same. Of course, the sound is not going to be entirely the same as a letter of istifal, for example, with kasra or ya'ulma. Because we
The root of the tongue is raised.
Is raised, yes. The sound is going to be different.
The lips, the shape of the lips help us.
Yes. فَإِذَا خِفْتِ عَلَيْهِ فَأَلْقِيهِ. Again, خِفْتِ and أَلْقِيهِ. Another قَاف, another letter of إِسْتِعْلَى, which is قَاف.
Again with كَسْرَة.
With كَسْرَة.
The lowest level of تَفْخِيم.
Yes. فِي الْيَمِّ. The meme has تَشْدِيد. Therefore, we have to apply nasalization. We have to hold the sound of meme for two vowel counts.
Yes.
فَأَلْقِيهِ فِي الْيَمِّ وَلَا تَخَافِي وَلَا تَحْزَنِي وَلَا تَخَافِي. Now we have the highest level of tafkhim here. If you say تَخَافِي, تَخَافِي,
that's you're not tafkhim.
Yeah. You're not reading this letter with enough tafkhim. It needs more tafkhim. تَخَافِي. The root of the tongue is raised and the mouth opens
vertically.
Vertically. And the jaws actually open vertically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because of course jaws same, only open vertically because there's no other way for jaws to
open.
وَلَا تَخَافِي وَلَا تَحْزَنِي إِنَّا رَادُّوهُ. We have مَتُّ اللَّازِم here. مَتُّ اللَّازِم takes place whenever there is a تَشْتِيت or سُكُون after a long vowel.
Mm-hmm.
And تَشْتِيت itself has a سُكُون in it.
Yes.
Because we have a ساكن letter of the same letter followed by the same letter with
حركة.
So that is why we could just say that the cause of مَتُّ اللَّازِم is سُكُون.
Okay. And it is lengthened to six vowel counts.
Just now, Sheikh Rab Mustafa Galwaj, he makes a small mistake, actually, in verse 9. When he reaches the Matul Munfasul, Asa'an, he does not lengthen it to five vowel counts. He lengthens it to four. Okay. It was a lot shorter than the first Matul Munfasuls that he read. And the last Matul Munfasul, it was five vowel counts.
So the consistency is not observed.
Yeah, it was just for that single Matul Munfasul. The other ones, they were all five vowel counts.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Please click on the tab Call of Islam, and there you can listen to this program as well as other programs of this radio. Until next time, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye. وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن ضياء يملأ الآفاق ونور يبعث الأشواق وفيه محاسن الأخلاق هو
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The talks will be indirect. We do not accept any way other than indirect talks.
Tehran announces high-level indirect negotiations with Washington, which will be held in Oman on Saturday. Israeli occupation military continues to kill more Palestinian women and children in Gaza, where nearly 60 deaths have been reported in one day. China and the EU have strongly reacted to Donald Trump's tariffs policies that have impacted global markets. And welcome from Tehran, you tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, first story takes us to Iran, which reaffirms its stance that negotiations with Washington will proceed only through indirect channels, ruling out any direct talks.
The negotiations will be held next Saturday in Oman. The talks will be indirect. We do not accept any way other than indirect talks.
Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the U.S. is trying to impose its will through pressure and coercion is not called negotiations, but rather an act of